Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weven. Alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad Riley and Spencer Williams.
What's up?
Howdy.
Yeah, I like the energy.
I really wish I could dinosaur roar right now. I just really want to... Roar!
Oh my gosh. And there goes the speakers to everybody who's listening to it in their car. As you can tell, we are going to be talking about Jurassic World, The Fallen Kingdom. We got a sneak peek, and we can't wait to talk to you about it. But before we do, Chad, give him a little bit of info.
Oh, sure. We spared no expense on the making of this episode of the Filmlosophers podcast.
That's right.
Yet we still needed a little help. As always, we are presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live at VGB Studios. Did you know you can find the Filmlosophers on any of your favorite streaming platforms? That's right. New episodes debut each Wednesday on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom, because life, finds a way.
That was funny because that's a Jurassic Park. I got you. I'm following.
I do what I can.
Don't let yourself get isolated on a tropical island off the coast of Costa Rica. Connect with us on our social media pages, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101 to join in on the conversation.
That's right.
Finally, you can access our entire library of dinosaur specimens, that is, previous episodes and other great content on our website at filmlosophers.com.
We swear, we're trying to help Spencer because he said he had a trouble with talking and reading at the same time.
It's just the pre-reading, really.
You know, it's okay, though, because you should have, if anybody who's been with us long enough, we had so many struggles when we first started this. We didn't know how we were going to formulate that first part of the show. So you're just going through all the same motions that we went through as we started. So don't worry about it, Spencer. Growing pains.
Well, it's not more of growing pains as it is my entire life. I've always had this problem, and I've never been able to fix it.
Well, I'll tell you what. We can't fix your life, but what we can do is fix up a good review about Jurassic Park, The Fallen Kingdom.
Jurassic World.
Or Jurassic Kingdom. Park 5, if you like.
Or Jurassic Park 5.
I love this music. Just give it a moment.
John Williams.
Okay, way to make that different. Shall I read the synopsis?
Go for it, Jack.
Wow, this is what happens, folks. 3 years after the destruction of the theme park and luxury resort Jurassic World, the island's dormant volcano begins roaring to life. Owen, played by Chris Pratt, and Claire, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, mount a campaign to rescue the remaining dinosaurs from this extinction-level event. Owen is driven to find Blue, his lead raptor, who is still missing in the wild, and Claire has grown a respect for these creatures. She now makes her mission. Arriving on the unstable island as lava begins raining down, their expedition uncovers a conspiracy that could return our entire planet to a perilous order not seen since prehistoric times.
I had to give you that.
I know.
There you go.
I feel like I'm at a theme park. It just makes me smile.
Directed by J.A. Bayona, the film stars Chris Pratt, Bryce Dallas Howard, BD Wong, Toby Jones, Ted Levine, Rafe Spell, and Jeff Goldblum. This film sees the return of characters Ian Malcolm, played by Jeff Goldblum, since the last time he played in the starring role in The Lost World Jurassic Park, which was back in 1997. So give or take about, 20 years since the last time we've seen him in a film like this.
Yeah.
And the release of this film marks the 25th anniversary of the genesis of the Jurassic Park franchise. So it's been...
This was the 25th anniversary movie?
Well, it's been 25 years since the first film came out.
So which, yes, to my previous question.
I mean, I'm pretty sure it's not meant to... I don't know.
While y'all are arguing, I'm just enjoying the music. I'm loving it.
25 years. This film marks the 25th anniversary of the film.
And this is what they chose to do.
Wow.
So the film actually... So Before we jump into that, Jurassic Park was released on June 11th of 1993. And this film is set to release at the end of this week, which is in the middle of June. So it's around still the same time. So yeah. 25 years.
25 years and going strong.
Chad.
So many dinosaurs.
I was just going to say, Chad is probably the biggest supporter for this franchise and fan of just dinosaurs in general.
Absolutely. I knew how to read dinosaur names in storybooks before I could read cat, dog, run, jump, swim, etc. Boy, girl, I could read Tyrannosaurus Rex. I knew what it was. Hmm. That's how much I love dinosaurs. So long ago.
Spencer, what's your attraction to dinosaurs? Did you always like them? Do you like them? Do you not like them?
Well, you know, they were a thing.
Well, obviously.
No, as a kid, I didn't know.
There's no conspiracy theory for that one.
They were a thing.
As a kid, no, I didn't really pay too much attention to dinosaurs. They were there, and then Jurassic Park came out, and then they were slightly cooler.
Hmm.
It's hard to be excited about something that's dead.
They're not dead. They're alive.
Wow.
I mean, in the real world.
Wow.
I do, too.
Man. It's hard to be excited about things that are dead.
Well, is that not true?
No.
It's not true. I'm very excited about this. I think I still have somewhere, I have my dinosaur encyclopedia that I got from a museum of natural history, I believe in Cleveland, Ohio, or Columbus, Ohio, one of the two. I don't know, wherever they have a natural history museum, because I'm from the Midwest originally. Uh-huh. But anyway, I had it, and it had all kinds of different species of dinosaurs, you know, discovered dinosaur bones and whatnot in it, and yeah, I would flip through it, read it, love it. I've read Jurassic Park 3 times, the book.
The book.
Which I hardly ever reread any book ever. Not because I don't like reading, but because I like reading new things. But mm-hmm. Jurassic Park I've read numerous times. The Lost World I've read twice. Still waiting for my dinosaurs that blend in with the chain link fence. Camouflage-like. I'm waiting for that.
Mm.
Still didn't get that in this film. They tried something similar with Indominus Rex in Jurassic World, but it wasn't the same.
Which I'm glad that, we'll get into that. In terms of myself, I had been one of those types who had the dinosaur toys growing up, and then the film came out, and I actually remember going to a drive-in to see this film. It was one of those double features, and this was the latter film that was showing, and I was essentially supposed to go to sleep. Like, it was one of those ones where, like, your parents say you go to the back seat so, you know, you can go and go to sleep.
I was going
to
say, you would have been really young. I was 10.
Oh, yeah. I was 8. I was
several years older than you.
7. I think it was 7 at the time.
It is still one of the most distinctive memories of my childhood.
Oh, yeah.
Seeing that movie in the theater. I remember, like, moments, like, moment after moment after moment of it.
Yeah. And same here, like when the film came up, I ended up not going to sleep. I was watching the entire thing, and I just remember this is probably going to be the greatest movie I will ever see, which turned out to be pretty much true for the sake of what it did. I say all that to say we obviously had a chance to see Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, which debuts this weekend, and we obviously got a sneak peek, and we're kind of torn. It's kind of there's kind of this like silent tension because Spencer's kind of jabbing at certain mindsets and certain thoughts and Chad's ready to rip roar and kind of gush about the film
every
a bit.
Every dinosaur.
And I'm just kind of like I'm still processing a lot because we just saw it a little bit ago. We went straight from the theater and we are now in the studio and we're recording,
which is rare. We don't usually do that. Usually we get a day or two to think.
So these are hot takes, people.
These are right out of the oven. So I guess let's just go ahead and jump right into it, and let's kind of talk about expectations. So going into this film, one of the biggest expectations, I'll go ahead and just kind of start this off. One of the biggest expectations that I was hoping was seeing a strong continuation of that first film. That first film was really good.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, it didn't have some of the things that the book talked about, like the... chain link fence blending.
I'm still waiting.
But there was a lot of great stuff that I remember from that first film back in 2015. I enjoyed it. I loved it. I thought it was very, it was a really great follow-up after so many years from Jurassic Park 3.
Boo, boo, magoo, boo.
Talking raptors.
Alan.
So bad.
I was I think the strongest thing that I was expecting was a really great follow-up to that film. Like, I wanted to see the story
to Jurassic
continue.
World.
To Jurassic World, yeah. Yes. I wanted to see a really great follow-up to that to make sure that, you know what, it wasn't just going to be a one-off thing. It was going to be a continuation because they were talking about franchises. They're throwing out names like trilogies and words like that, buzzwords like that, and saga and franchise and, you know, things of that nature. So when you throw names like that out, you need to make sure that you can follow up on your first part of that and kind of give a strong second punch. So that was honestly literally the only expectation I had. I had heard a bunch of other stuff. I was, you know, between the people that we do reviews through and all that kind of stuff, you know, with the rushing of certain things. And there's just a lot of stuff in the background that
there was a lot of background chatter on this one.
There was. And it kind of begins to make you... So, being a member of the press, you are privy to certain pieces of information. Some of those being, when it comes to films, some of those are the way they want to, get the information from the critics as soon as possible, how quickly. There's things like embargo dates, embargo being the time when the film is going to be allowed to be talked about by members of the press. There's a lot of that. And this film had a little bit of chatter from the higher ups, and so it kind of got us a little scared.
It had a few more guidelines slash rules than you typically see.
Yeah. So that, you know, kind of started getting my mind a little bit to wander yesterday. But I thought about it today. I'm like, you know what? I'm just gonna go in fresh. I'm gonna keep like just the main expectation that I had when I went to go see it. When I was gonna go see it. And so, yeah. What about you, Chad?
I went in very curious. I like I said, I have been a huge fan of dinosaurs since I was old enough to talk. I distinctly remember every Jurassic Park movie, seeing it in the theater. I was very pleasantly surprised by Jurassic World when that came out a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Snatched that up as soon as it came out on Blu-ray. And yeah, there was a lot of chatter even before the rules from the studio execs and all that saying, hey, members of the press, we need this, this, and this, and not that. Even before that kind of stuff was happening recently, there was some chatter behind the scenes for several months about whether or not you had the right guy in the director's seat, whether or not the storyline was the appropriate continuation of the franchise. Obviously, we're way off book at this point in terms of what Michael Crichton originally wrote, and he's no longer with us, hasn't been for many years, so there aren't more stories, you know, book stories to base these off of. This is all derivative material at this point, and has been for the last several films. But all that taken in consideration, you know, you see the whole overly dramatized, the island is exploding and they're all running with the dinosaurs off of a cliff, and you know, all of these big moments in the trailers. And I definitely went in thinking, maybe they reach too far with this one. Like, they don't let the dinosaurs be the attractor. They think that they need to do something else. That's the impression that I went in with, and I was worried that they were going to do too much spectacleizing, you know, including the volcano and whatever other things. Obviously, the trailers seem to indicate that one or more dinosaurs end up back on the mainland, which we know from The Lost World, Jurassic Park. That was a train wreck of a coda to that film.
Yeah.
not to be repeated, and yet it seems like they are repeating it here. So I went in with a lot of uncertainty, but also a lot of hope, because I don't want them to stop making these movies. I really enjoy them. Like, the child inside of me delights with these movies. Even the horrific parts of them, which, as you know, I'm not a horror movie person. I don't like gore and violence in that way. Tension usually reads to me as contrived.
Yeah.
And yet these movies have moments of gore and contrived tension that reads totally authentic to me. Like, I think it's because it's a younger version of me that watches these movies in the older me's body. But
yeah,
I went in thinking, you know, uh-oh, I might really actually not like this one, similar to Jurassic Park 3, which I wasn't very fond of.
Mm.
But yeah, so that's what I went in with. I guess I'll stop there for now. I went in uncertain if I was going to like it and hoping that it proved me wrong.
Spence, drum roll. Let's try to keep it to less than an hour here. What were your expectations?
Okay, so I was concerned upon walking into this movie because just looking at the trailer for Jurassic World, there was something off about it. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was the way like how Owen and Claire were talking in that bar in the trailer that was kind of off-putting to me, but there was something about it that's like, I'm mildly concerned for this movie now after seeing the trailer. But I was like, you know, Jurassic World was really good, and that came after Jurassic Park 3, which, you know, I thought there was no redemption for the series after that.
You mean talking to raptors wasn't the highlight of your life, your cinematic life there? Like,
No, it wasn't. I was tired of talking raptors. I was tired of, what's her name? Tia Leone screaming Eric and just screaming constantly. Like, we need to get away from screaming for nothing.
Yeah, it was pretty much the worst.
So after that, I was like, well, I feel like they probably have learned like some valuable lessons after part three. And, you know, there's probably certain areas where we're not going to traipse back. And there was a little bit of traipsing back, which, you know, I wasn't a big fan of.
Well, obviously, there were high expectations in terms of wanting to make sure this film succeeded. I think that was probably the biggest thing for all three of us, is that the film, we were hoping the film was going to succeed in certain terms, in terms of it being a great continuation, it being, you know, great exploration of dinosaurs, and for this one to kind of soothe this one. And when I'm pointing at Spencer. I know, podcast, got it. It's okay, Spence. They can't hear me after you blew their speakers with your roar. No, but so that was kind of the I guess setting the playing field and setting the foundation. But jumping right in, it's interesting that with this particular film. So this is, if you're unfamiliar, if you've been living under a rock for the last 25 years, the Jurassic Park series, the Jurassic Park franchise itself, is kind of a child's dream, if you will, in terms of filmmaking, because what this film does, what this franchise does, is it brings dinosaurs from way back when into the modern era, and it allows moviegoers to experience the kind of mindset of what would happen if scientists brought back dinosaurs to the current day and age. And I think there's a little bit of fascination with that because of the fact that dinosaurs, like Chad was saying, are one of those things where you just don't really ever grow out of. I mean, as long gone as they've been, I'm literally looking at Chad, and Chad has a Tyrannosaurus Rex on his t-shirt, and it says, if you're happy and you know it, clap your O. And it's
epic.
It's a great shirt.
Totally epic.
But it proves my point in terms of, like, people have been wanting to visualize this for so long and see this, and Jurassic Park, the first film, did this. And it's kind of part of that magical experience of going to one of these films and seeing how further they can go down this rabbit hole, if you will.
I mean, they definitely do need to not keep telling the same story. They need to let things evolve. We had in Jurassic World, for example, because the first trilogy, if you will, was really about, oh, this was a mistake. And by the way, there are two islands, so there are two mistakes. And just the deterioration of the process. Jurassic World, they had wealthy investors who actually successfully opened a theme park. the original vision for Jurassic Park had evolved into Jurassic World, and they had actual, like, everyday Joes with a lot of money flying out to this island and attending the theme park and seeing the dinosaurs in their enclosures and whatnot, just like you would see animals in a zoo. So obviously in that film, things go wrong because they're big fancy, you know, designer dino that they made in a lab got loose and, you know, everything went to pot after that. And they end up abandoning the island. Surprise, surprise. Mm. And so now in this film, you've got to reestablish why, you've got to establish why they would go back to the island. Obviously, we've seen numerous times some more sordid elements of our money-grubbing capitalist society, yeah, profiteering, that, you know, just want to use these creatures to make money. And so that's a component. But also in this one, because of the volcano that is erupting and has been in the trailers for months, so if you don't know that, it's not a spoiler. It's just, you should really check it out on YouTube, yeah, or just turn on your TV, because they've been doing a massive ad campaign for the film. But so you also have the conservationist mindset, also a major voice in this film, where you have characters like Claire in particular. They really say in the literature for the film, it's Owen and Claire. It's really Claire.
Yeah.
who's all about saving them now, even though she was kind of in charge before and she represented the profiteering interests in the last film until near the end, and then she kind of changed her tune.
Yeah.
Now she's a do-gooder trying to save them, leverage, you know, lobby Congress and whatnot to pass legislation to go and get them off the island and save them. Owen himself is kind of just a bit of a recluse. He's not really wanting to go back. He ultimately does, because you wouldn't have a movie without that decision. But
yeah, if he would have stuck with no, I think the movie would have ended there.
But I think that once you get through that initial, like, okay, how do they get back there? Why do they go back there? Everything from that point forward, I thought, did have a certain element of maybe not a fresh story, but a fresh take on a familiar story. Also, they put a lot more dinosaurs in it, like species that we haven't seen yet on screen, or we haven't seen them featured. And I really enjoyed it, seeing that many dinosaurs, that many different ones.
I don't know. I think for me, the film, so I think the way the film begins and it gets going and it introduces your characters, obviously, as people have seen from the trailer, there is a trial going on, a court case, if you will, on, you know, the dinosaurs and whatnot. And Jeff Goldblum's character, Ian Malcolm, is giving his testimony before the committee. And so as you're introduced to all these characters and you're introduced to everything that's going on, I think the film actually begins to turn into a box of lit fireworks after that point in my mind. Like, I liked everywhere it went, but I just thought there was a lot going on to kind of stay in tune with a lot what was happening. I mean, I enjoyed it all. Like, I enjoyed the amount of action once they get to the island, everything that's happening and whatnot. But I think there was an idea to do a lot for the film, but also make sure it fit the time frame. And even though the film was 2 hours long, I believe it was about
like two hours and 9 minutes or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I felt like I could have broken this as a whole. I think I could have broken this film into two pieces, and I would have loved to have seen each half as a 2 hour piece, as opposed to this whole film kind of being crunched into that 2 hour time frame. Because I think that's one of the things that this film does, is it kind of puts a lot happening that I have to process throughout the entire film. And I really don't get a lot of time to process through, because I'm on to the next scene and I'm moving forward. And that, like I said, that doesn't take away from how much is happening. Like, a lot of the stuff that is happening, it's constant movement from beginning to end. But
Yeah, I mean, definitely. If you lose your footing in the beginning, you're not catching up.
No.
It does not wait for you to catch up to the story. You've got to go with it the whole time, for sure. Because it, I mean, it goes. There's a little bit of quietness in the beginning where you've got some tension because of what's happening. And you're like, yeah, okay, you know something is going to happen in this first scene.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, as soon as stuff starts happening in the beginning, all the way through to the end, you are in motion.
Oh, yeah. What do you think, Spence? In terms of just the way, the pacing of it and everything. Deep breath, and now he's...
I thought it was paced fine. I was keeping up with everything as it went. I did have a minor problem with them, like, over-explaining certain things. Because there were certain topics that came up that, like, you know, they showed you it. And, like, you know, you got the gist of what they were trying to do. They didn't have to come back around and be like, well, this happened. And it's like, well, we knew that. We already saw that. You told us that like 5 minutes ago. Why are we back here?
Mm. No, that's true as well. I think that's that goes back to, in my mind, I think that goes back to just kind of putting so much into the film where I think the fear of like losing people mm-hmm. goes back to people who are already focused and so already ingrained in what's happening in the film. It kind of reestablishes, like, so, by the way, right now, this is happening. The island's this, blah, 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 boom. And just continues forward. But that also goes to, like, how the director moves. Like, J.A. Bayona is not your typical director, if you will. If you've ever heard of the name, J.A. Bayona is also the same one who did films like A Monster Calls. He did...
Which is deeply emotional.
Oh, yeah.
Like, deeply emotional.
Well, and it's interesting because...
Based on an incredible book, by the way.
It's funny, not the movie, not that particular movie, but it's interesting that Chad is the only one pretty much who has the most amount of information about this particular director because he's seen A Monster Calls and he's seen The Impossible.
I love The Impossible. It's a really, really hard movie to get through.
Mm.
Because it's based on actual events. I mean, it's based on a family's experience during the tsunami in Indonesia. And they're separated. And it's Ewan McGregor, Naomi mm-hmm. Watts, Tom Holland. Was like 12 or 10. Gives an incredible performance in that movie. It is a brutal, like emotionally draining, but beautiful movie.
Mm-hmm.
Very well told. Especially given the sensitive topic, you know, what the story is about. It's not a fictional story.
Yeah.
It's a dramatization of actual events. A Monster Calls is a fictional story. The book and the story behind the book are incredible. Like, again, deeply moving and very well treated. And then now you've got not only J.A. Bayona, I actually did want to bring up, he's a protege of your main squeeze.
Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah. So, and I think you can definitely see a lot of Del Toro's influence in, I mean, obviously the easy play would be like creature design, right? Like paying attention to the details of the creatures in ways that you haven't literally since the first film. Since Steven Spielberg did animatronic and digital creatures and a mix of them so that you notice the detail on the T-Rex, on the raptors, etc. Here, you've got such an intense focus sometimes on the way that the creature is made. Whatever creature you're looking at the time. There are a lot of them in this one, which is nice for a fan like me. But also in terms of the way that the camera is used.
Yeah.
And the way that... that certain tense moments are foreshadowed and played out and not rushed. I really thought, man, this does feel a lot like Del Toro. Like, you know, Bayona is his own creative, you know, mind, and he's been in the industry for many years. But I felt like there was quite a bit of the influence of Guillermo del Toro that you could feel in certain sequences in the movie, like. He consulted on this sequence. Feel it.
Yeah.
You can see it through his eyes almost.
Like, I think, I guess an easy target for that is like some of the scenes with, you know, obviously there's dinosaurs in this film. I don't know if anybody knows that. But
surprise.
Spoiler alert.
Dinosaurs.
But in certain instances where there may be a dinosaur looming in the background or on its way, the way those particular scenes are shot, you're right, 100%. I think those were definitely consulted with Guillermo del Toro in terms of how he, you know, just creates that tension, that quiet tension that you don't realize until it's too late, essentially. And I think there's a lot of, like, from a technical standpoint, this film really does excel at creating consistent tension throughout the film.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think that's one of the things that we can just outright...
I mean, the opening sequence, we had people sitting behind us who were literally screaming.
Oh, my God.
And it wasn't even that intense yet.
It wasn't.
And they were screaming.
Yeah. But that goes to show, like, in terms of just the influence, like you were saying, and the ability to create... Because it's difficult to do something like that. Like,
yeah,
for a film that's not meant for horror. Like, this was not a horror film at all.
No.
This film was not made to be, like, you know, a slash and kill type of film. This wasn't any one of those things. This was a film that was focused on bringing the true horrors of having something that died out millions of years ago and a common, you know, era of life and combining the two. And this does a really great job of creating those moments where we tend to forget not every single dinosaur kills by, you know, just roaring and tearing you apart. Some of them are very methodical and do it very clever, you know, in a very clever manner or very, you know, subtle or they use... It's crazy. And we tend to forget that.
Well, and sometimes, I mean, what they really did well in this movie that they have not done very much, they started to toy with it a little bit in Jurassic World because of the way that the character of Owen relates to his raptors, and you get some of those shadings of personality. But in this film, almost every dinosaur has, like, definable personality traits. Even from the first time, for example, you see the T-Rex. And this is the same T-Rex that you've seen the whole time. Like,
yeah,
not the whole time. There were other T-Rexes in the Lost World. But, like, this T-Rex is, like, the original T-Rex.
Oh, yeah.
And she's been around for a good many years. She's,
for forever.
She's used to humans. Like,
yeah,
there's been an adaptation, an evolution in the way that she hunts humans, the way that she postures herself is different. Certainly some of the more intelligent skewing dinosaurs, definitely, especially the new one, the Indoraptor.
Yeah.
I mean, it straight up has personality. Like, it's a fully cognizant, like, I'm playing with my food kind of personality at certain points. That is not... it's not just some vacant-eyed animal killer. There's intent. There's some humor, oddly, at times. And I think that that's really
impressive.
From the dinosaurs. And again, looking at Del Toro and what he typically does, which is learning how, like, showing us how these creatures demonstrate a whole range of emotions and personality and subtext and all of these things that you normally would rely on a human actor to do, or emotion capture, you know, performance. Here you're getting that effect in a lot of different cases. Even the little Packy that, you know, has the headbutting stuff,
yeah,
has some really definable personality to it. And it totally serves its purpose in the story. And then, you know, you don't have to spend too much time with it to enjoy it, you know, how much it's on the screen and what it's doing. But I really enjoyed the texture, beyond just the skin tone and the shape of the dinosaur and how it roars and you know, whatever. But, like, they really did a lot of work on these creatures.
Yeah.
To make them all stand out.
Yeah, I think that's one of the really big highlights in terms of, for this day and age, this being, like, an HD age, you know, 4K, you know, higher resolution than 1080p, or just
having these high quality phones, having a film where you can see the, like, almost like the individual portions of the way, like, a certain dinosaur's skin is made up of, or seeing, like, the wrinkles so close that you can see where, like, the colors separate on a particular dinosaur's back, or the way their jawline moves and the muscles in the jawline, you know, contract and expand, and they as the dinosaur is doing stuff. I think that's a really great thing to make sure you don't forget about, because of the fact that this could easily have been overlooked in any other situation. I mean, had it not been like a Jurassic Park film, I think the care may not have actually been there. And it could have just been, oh, well, yeah, there's dinosaurs here, but our main focus is just people and doing this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that J.A. Bayona really does well in terms of highlighting that.
And you even have artistic moments. I mean, we don't want to give very much away, but, I mean, there's a very, I mean, it's almost paintbrush-like. There's an effect that's done at one point as the volcano's going off and the humans are escaping the island, and not all the dinosaurs make it off. And there's one dinosaur in particular that, like, you have an extended.
What is wrong with you?
No, I'm sorry. I'll say something after you're done.
You have an extended moment that is actually treated artistically and lingered upon so that it sets in, so that it's not just an effect. You're meant to emotionally feel something. You know, because it lingers on this sequence.
All right, Mr.
Go ahead and laugh.
Mr. Horrible over here.
No, it wasn't about, like, chess. It's just, when I saw that scene, it was just one little dinosaur on a pier. And it was like, why is it there? There's, like, tons of space that's not on fire that it could probably go to. It's like it heard about the boat, and it's like, I got to get down to the dock. I'm like, I don't understand why it was there.
So the death of this dinosaur, if I'm understanding, is equating to a joke of somebody who woke up late to get to the pier.
Basically, yes. It was really funny to me.
Well, I'm glad you found humor in that, Spencer. It was a very touching scene, actually.
Yeah, no, I do agree with you, Chad, though. It was really
Yeah, we can see how well you agreed with him.
It was really...
It's like, I agree. That was so touching. made me cry. Yeah.
All right. I'm not going to... Anymore?
But I think one thing to kind of note, obviously, J.A. Bayona was the director, but there was also a writer to the film that actually is pretty notable, and that was Colin Trevorrow. And again, if you're familiar with any of these names, Colin Trevorrow was the guy who actually wrote... he's going to write the next episode for Star Wars. He also directed a film that we actually covered, The Book of Henry. So he's known in the arena of doing certain particular screenplays, and I think one of the things that
he did Jurassic World.
He was the director
like
for the first one.
He kind of reignited the franchise. He was actually the primary kind of creative thrust for this one, just didn't have time, I think, because of the Book of Henry, and because they had contracted him for Star Wars Episode 9, which now is J.J. Abrams, so he's been bumped from that project. But
bumped.
So that's how Bayona came into the director's seat for this one.
Gotcha.
Actually,
One of the things I kind of wanted to highlight was the way this film... So we talked a little bit about structure, and we talked about kind of where this film goes. The film does bear some type of resemblance to The Lost World in a bit, in terms of the structure of recognizing a need, going to the island, coming back to the mainland. And but I think the one thing that The Lost World does that this one doesn't is, for sake of a volcano, it spends a little bit more time on the island, obviously. So this film, when it transitions over to the mainland, one of the things that I really struggled with this particular film was how, and I guess it goes back just to my view of the pacing, was how quickly it jumped from major point to major point to major point to major point without kind of giving a little bit of that breathing room. Like I said, this film was 2 hours, but so much happened in that last, what, hour? Because I think by the time they get back to the mainland, there's still an hour left in the film. I think it really just, I struggled with kind of investing myself into a lot of the key moments that were kind of important for the overall push of the story. I don't, was that just me, Spencer? Did you feel anything similar, or how did you feel about the way the film was structured in that latter half?
I didn't really have a problem with it.
You're killing me, Smalls.
Sorry.
Well, I think it definitely does. It's sort of like it goes from set piece to set piece to set piece to set piece to set piece, because
yeah,
you're there for the spectacle. I mean, that's,
yeah,
that's why you're there. You know, could they have done more to draw things out? Absolutely. I wish that they would have done even more than they did on the Owen and Blue relationship, because there's a lot that's in this movie in little bits and pieces about when Blue was a baby raptor.
Yeah.
You know, like the bond that they developed back then, there's footage that you see from when she was a baby raptor and how she behaved differently, definably differently than all the other raptors that they had ever tried to train.
Yeah.
And she's a crucial component of the storyline.
Yeah.
On each side of the competing interests, the bad guys, so to speak, want her for certain reasons. The good guys want to keep her out of the bad guys' hands.
Yeah.
For, you know, the heartbeat kind of reasons.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But all that being said, she's not really in the movie that much. Mm-hmm. And they could have done more to develop some of that, those quieter nuances and touches of how that works and why it's important versus action to action to action to action to action.
Yeah. Like, I feel like there could be an entire, like, almost short film series just based on Blue and Owen, like, alone.
Sure.
That it almost feels like that could be some kind of, like, Nickelodeon Nick Kids show.
No, that is a show right there. Like, you just have, like, Blue and Owen, like, attacking bad guys. You know,
yeah.
Owen and Raptor.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I don't know what kind of kids show you would show. I was just thinking something like a little bit less violent and non-attacking. It's the baby raptor. I'm not talking about the big raptor. I'm talking about baby raptor.
Oh, do the big raptor and then just put in the stupid Batman effects from the 60s.
Oh, yeah. Chomps down on someone. Pow. Crunch. Bite.
Fits flawlessly.
I would watch it. I would totally watch
Spurt.
It.
Spurt. Splatter.
Oh, well, now you're just being grotesque.
What else is going to happen? But I think for me, that was part of, like, part of that last hour seemed to be filled. And that goes back to what I was talking about earlier in terms of the pacing. I think there was just so much that was happening from pivotal moments with the main antagonist, with key moments with the main protagonists, with the side characters who just really... In all honesty, I could have done out with maybe one of them.
I bet I know which one you wanted to take out.
I don't know. It just because of the fact that it overlooked a lot of moments where they could have really shined, in my mind. But apparently, Spence has no clue what I'm talking about. So, no, I'm just kidding. It's one of those things where I just really wanted more breathing room. You know, I enjoyed a lot of what I was seeing, but the fact remains is that I couldn't really allow some of it to really sink in because I was already invested into the next scene that was happening. Hmm. Like what Chad was talking about with the Indoraptor, there were some really great scenes with that thing. And it was like, man, how smart it is and how almost evil. I mean, it just naturally was in certain instances. And it's like, You're watching this thing do its thing, and you're like, oh, whoa, and you're about to start processing exactly what you just saw, and it's already jumping to the next thing, and it's already moving forward to something else that you need to focus on.
One of the things that this movie did really well for me was harken back, especially to the first film, in terms of the way certain shots and sequences work. There were a lot of throwback elements And I don't say that in the sense of like, oh, this was lazy filmmaking. Like, I was delighted by, you know, the way that there's a quiet, ish chase sequence between the Indoraptor and Owen, Claire, and a little girl named Macy, who we haven't really talked about yet, but, that harkens back to Tim and Lexi versus the raptors in the kitchen.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you've got the, like, trying to sneak around and do they hear me? And then charging down the hallway. I mean, they even have Macy in a dumbwaiter. Hello. Like, that's from the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
Plays out a little differently, but it was so fulfilling to see, like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Like, just remind me what I loved so much about that one, but do it a little differently so it feels fresh here. I'm all on board with that. Or when the Indoraptor enters Macy's bedroom and you've got the shadow on the wall,
yeah,
harkening back to the raptors in the dining hall,
yeah,
in the first one, and quite a few other things, you know, as well, in terms of shot for shot kind of opportunities to compare.
Yeah.
I really liked it because to me, those were the quiet moments. Those were the quiet, like, we know what universe we're inhabiting. Mm-hmm. We remember what made that one so good and memorable and worth watching again and again and again. And it's that quiet, like, wink that you get every 20 minutes or so. There's another one, like, oh, that's like that part in the first one where whatever, whatever, whatever.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, like, the T-Rex's eye. Hello, like, yeah, they're not shining a flashlight into it like in the first one, but like the eye is right there and it fixes on him. Like, yeah, the tingles happened all over again, not because of this movie, but because of 10-year-old me,
yeah,
who saw the original movie and got tingles.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that you can say about this film. It does give homage to a lot of it being the 25th anniversary. I think that really had a lot to do with it. In terms of this release, this film really does pay a lot of homage to that first film. Even to there's a scene, and this was like where it really kind of solidified my mindset in terms of okay, they're doing this intentionally. There's a scene where one of the dinosaurs is actually on the floor after it got tranked, and you see this overhead shot of it, and it looks exactly like the dinosaur dig that was in the very first film at the very beginning.
First thing you saw.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, okay. And you got to give props to that because that's just being respecting the genesis, if you will, of this franchise, what kind of got this whole thing rolling in the first place. And you have to respect that. I mean, that's something that you could totally overlook. You could totally be like, as a director, you could say, okay, this is a whole new thing. I'm doing something totally different. I'm totally, you know, redoing this whole franchise. We're using the same universe, but we're doing our own thing. And seeing that J.A. Bayona took the time to recreate certain instances or give homage to certain instances, that I think is something that's just out of respect as a filmmaker, you have to admire.
And even things among the humans. I mean, you've got Justice Smith's character is like a tech guru. Like, he's able to open doors and, you know, whatever. And he literally, at one point, they get to a point where the facility that they're in is malfunctioning, and you get to a decision where you have to reboot the system, which is what happened in the first movie. Mm-hmm. And you even have, like, maps, like, virtual maps of doors that are working and doors that are not working. I mean, there's so much in this movie that I would say, and forgive me if you just loved The Force Awakens to no end. I don't have anything against The Force Awakens, necessarily, but there were things in that movie that just felt like, oh, like, literally that, but in a new skin. Like, literally that exact same, almost felt almost like line for line sometimes. In terms of the way that characters spoke or the way that the visuals worked and even the order of the visuals. Here, you've got all these flashback kind of touch points, but they're done a little differently. They're done in a different sequence, and it just felt more accomplished to me personally. Like the Allosaur, there the volcano is starting to really, really erupt, and Claire and is it Franklin? Justice Smith's character?
Yeah.
Claire and Franklin are trapped in a bunker. The door has locked on them. They can't get out. And an Allosaur, which is a predator, comes in and is going to eat them. And they have to escape vertically up a pipe. And the Allosaur is, you know, jumping up at them, coming up into the pipe. That's what the raptors did near the end of the first movie.
Yeah.
But this sequence is near the beginning of this movie. So it's like, this is that, but it's in a different place, and it's a different dinosaur, different humans, you know, slightly different sequence, but it's so familiar. I don't know. Like I had tingles the whole time. Like it reminded me of all these things that I loved about the first movie. The goat was there, for crying out loud, at one point.
Yes, there was a goat. Spencer, was there anything that stuck out to you in terms of this film, whether good or bad, that you kind of really want to highlight? He's rolling his eyes, people. He's looking at us like he's not wanting to open the can of worms, but he's gonna open
no,
it.
No. There's a open few it. Most of my problems with this movie I can't talk about because they're spoilers. So I try to choose the other things that aren't spoily. I'm gonna just go back to what you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And say I would like to delete Franklin Webb from the movie because I feel like I don't like him. That's what it really comes down to.
I mean, that's actually what I was talking about.
Can you explain, like, is it a character issue, or is it the actions that he does or doesn't take? Like, what is it that...
Or do you have this thing against this person personally?
No. It's not against the person personally.
I don't know. I don't like Paul Rudd, so I'm just saying.
Oh, gosh. Let's not get into that. No, it's just, I didn't like his character because I feel like he was kind of a cliched, I'm a nerdy IT guy,
which,
blah, blah,
For those who don't know, Spencer actually works in IT.
Yeah.
He is an IT technician. So this is something that I think he has a little bit of expertise to talk on. So go ahead, Spencer. Yeah, the floor is yours.
Yeah, you just have to throw that out there.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Like, one of the first scenes you see him in, like, him and Owen are talking to each other. And, like, at the end of it, he's like, we're not compatible. And I'm like, is that supposed to be a joke? Is that funny? Like, maybe it's just that I don't understand him as a character because we are going really fast. And he does disappear through, like part of the movie. He's just gone doing his own thing.
That is true. He gets roped into one kind of role, and the next time you see him, he's doing a completely different thing, and they also still haven't noticed that he shouldn't be there.
Yeah, that was the one time I was like, I want to know what your day was like, because what happened? That was the only thing about the movie where I was like, we should have, like, just popped in for, like, 2 seconds.
Did you get to know the rest of your crew?
How did you get here?
Because he's leaving by being pulled off by one of the guys who's working on the boat, and the next time you see him, he's in scrubs.
Yeah, he's like one of the scientist people.
Like, what happened in that amount of time between? That's a great point.
Yeah.
That's a really great point. Anything else?
I don't think anything I can talk about.
I will say, in terms of things that we won't go into a whole lot, I did not recall seeing James Cromwell on the cast list before going into this movie.
No,
and when he
here.
Showed up, I was like, oh, that's James Cromwell. And then the character he's playing, nobody that we've heard of before, but has strong connections to...
John Hammond.
John Hammond, the guy who originally created Jurassic Park. And so you learn a lot more. This film does more than any of them have, I think, to really try to enlarge your understanding as the audience, your understanding of the entire, like, map of the story. Like, it's reaching further into the past than you've ever reached. And they're taking this, like, genetic experimentation thing further forward than they've ever taken it at the same time. And I think that that kind of, it really, it's like pulling the canvas pretty taut. You know, like, it depends on how elastic your mind is, how much you're willing to take in a 2-hour chunk of time, which I think is a lot of what you've been mentioning this entire time, is that it's a lot of information to deal with. And because they don't take the time to deal with any one part fully, really, they're just sort of like, they're, it's like they're taking, I imagine, like, dough, like pizza dough or cookie dough, and you're just like stretching it out or rolling it out, but you're, it's not yet ready to fully bake.
Yeah.
You're just making it bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot that happens in the movie.
There is.
Don't get me wrong. Like, there's a lot that happens in this movie, but the purpose of this story is to make the canvas of the franchise bigger than you thought it was.
Yeah.
Especially when you get into some of the things we're not going to get into, involving some of the human characters, one in particular, that really expands the canvas potentially too far.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the biggest, I think, issue. If there was one, I could say overall, it's just the same one I've been saying, in terms of I really wanted to know more of the things, or I really wanted to spend more time on the unique little things that they were dropping, because we're talking about 25 years of a franchise, and this film doesn't just touch on this film and Jurassic World, the first one of this newer franchise, or this newer trilogy. It's touching on all 25 years of information, going back to, like Chad was saying, about John Hammond and the inception of Jurassic Park and creating it and whatnot. And it talks about, you know, the I guess the architects, if you will, of this idea. And I just, there was so much that was happening that it's like getting one of those museum tours and you just really want to stay at one exhibit because you just want to focus a little bit more and see and read a little bit more, but the whole group is going this way and you're going to get lost if you don't catch up. It's one of those situations where I didn't want to get lost and I didn't want to focus too much on it because something else important was happening. And mind you, here's the kicker. It's not that the other things that were happening were not important. They were just as important. They were impactful. They were action-packed. They were great. They were really good scenes. But because of the fact that there was so much happening, I couldn't really take the time to enjoy all of them. And I think there were instances that I feel like I kind of missed out on in experiencing fully, because instead of relishing in one particular part, I had to kind of jump to the next thing and jump to the next
thing.
It
does kind of. I mean, I know we were joking earlier about Owen and Blue, like having a show. I would legit watch that show.
I'd watch it.
Owen and Blue, right? But but along that wavelength, it does make you kind of want tie-in materials, like comic books or novels or novellas or TV shows, you know, that kind of dig in to some of those angles, because there's actually a lot of richness in some of those kind of side thoughts that never get fully played out.
I think this is a perfect example of kind of like what Star Wars is doing currently in terms of enriching that expanded universe that is now becoming canon by inputting so much filler, I guess, in a good way, type of content. Like, we got, obviously, you have all the episodes, but they also have, like, Clone Wars cartoon. They have Star Wars Rebels. They got anthological pieces now that are films that people can enjoy. There's books upon books upon books that are still constantly being dropped. And I think understanding that concept of world building not only enriches the experience for the moviegoer, but it continues that magic. It continues that dive deeper into the world that is being created. And it if in all honesty, it helps you feel included.
Yeah.
You know? Before we go, what do you guys think in terms of the possibility of another film? Do you guys think there's going to be another film, or do you think that it's going to kind of leave right here? Because obviously, we're not going to talk about how the film ends. We're not going to let you know. But the likeliness of this film possibly being not the last, where do you guys see that at?
Do you think that this film will have another one? Or
I would hope so, because like they have set up a rather interesting premise at the end of this movie that, you know, I would like to see a continuation of, because I don't really know where they would go with it. It could be pretty interesting.
It is kind of, and much of this comes from Jeff Goldblum, who I wanted so much more Goldblum in this movie.
Why is he not in this more than that?
Well, he'll be in the next one.
God willing. But Grandmaster in Jurassic Park.
There's, and this really goes all the way back before the first movie. Mm. The book itself, Jurassic Park, the book by Michael Crichton, every section, every chapter, I think, but every section has a quote from Dr. Ian Malcolm, the character that Jeff Goldblum ends up playing in the film.
Huh.
Ian Malcolm's perspective is the guiding thought of this story. Like the cautionary tale that he keeps telling with his words, that is the intellectual takeaway from the entire, like, oh, we've cloned dinosaurs and brought them back to life idea. Like the whole like chaos theory and all of that, that is the foundational intellectual premise, the backbone, if you will, of the story as it was originally conceived. And it develops over the course of the novel, like where you've got these quotes from Ian Malcolm, and it just like that's the way that the story plays out. He is correct. He is right. It's not a matter of opinion. He's saying, when you study the patterns of order falling into chaos, this is what you see. And that's the way it works in the microcosm of the park. And now that you've gotten to movie 5, the canvas of the story, as we were mentioning before, is so much bigger than it was before. And Ian Malcolm is back in this movie specifically to speak these maxims. Basically, this is what we should have expected the whole time. This is the only thing that you can expect from what we have done.
Yeah.
Unless we correct what we have done, this is what's going to continue to compound and compound and compound. And I think that's where they're going to go with the next one, because this is clearly the second part of a three-part story to me.
Yeah.
Well, with that, let's go ahead and go around the table. Passes or fails, and how many monocles? And let's go ahead and start with Mr. Dinosaur Boy himself, Chad Riley.
passes for me. I'm going to give it 4 out of 5. Loved all really? The dinosaurs. I really do. I would read the books. I would read the comic books. I would watch the cartoons. I would watch live action. I would access all of the quote-unquote expanded universe content,
yeah,
because I really like these stories, and I think that there is definitely like a primary filament in this one that follows through on the story promises of the first movie in ways that none of the other ones have even tried yet. I think that's to their group credit, the multiple collaborators who worked on this film. At the same time, I think there are some narrative threads that are not followed up on very well. There are some things that are glossed over and oversimplified, as there always are. And I'm not sure that that I would have made some of the same choices with regard to which characters we're focusing on.
Yeah.
And I mean that in terms of people and dinosaurs. I wanted a lot more Jeff Goldblum, Ian Malcolm. I also wanted a lot more Blue in this movie. So yeah. 4 out of 5 for me.
The film passes for me. It does a good job at continuing the story from the first film. But as I said earlier, I did have issues following the pacing of the film, making sure that my focus was on where it needed to be and giving me the amount of breathing room I needed to fully invest in what was happening in the film. So with that said, plus the egregious act of not including more Jeff Goldblum really does not
egregious. Listen to you.
It is horrendous.
What are you, a lawyer?
It is horrendous as to how little this man is used in this film. And, I think
I know he probably filmed his entire sequence in a day.
No, actually, I think
or maybe two based on like makeup.
Yeah, 100%. I think it was in two separate days that he did it.
Yeah.
So with that said, like I said, I passed the film. I am going to give it a 3 out of 5. It is a passable film. It is something that you'll enjoy in terms of action packed, but in terms of really kind of finding the breathing room for this film, that's one thing you probably won't be able to find.
Guillermo would be disappointed in you.
Cool. I know he would. Spencer.
Yeah, this movie passed for me.
It passes.
You seem shocked.
Well, the eye rolls kind of give it away. Not to mention you laughing at one of the most touching parts of the film.
That was really bad, too.
Like,
okay, was it a touching moment? Because it was ridiculous. This brontosaurus on a pier. Why is it there? I still don't get it. Anyway,
because it was sad.
It didn't make it on time. It needed to. It was trying to live.
It woke up.
Who
late.
Told it about the boat? Anyway, I give this movie a 3 out of 5. I'm very perplexed by the whole brontosaurus pier thing.
What if that was Littlefoot's mom?
What?
Oh, brother.
No, it's a clone of anything. But like, I have some problems with things I can't talk about, which is always great on a review.
We'll have a therapy session off mic after this.
Oh, we will. But I would like to say even though this isn't really about the movie, it's about the soundtrack. What's his name? Michael Giacchino, or however you pronounce it.
It's like Giacchino or something like that. It's very Italian.
Yeah, I can't pronounce it. But I want to say
Giacchino, maybe?
Really appreciate like the puns that he always puts in the titles of the Jurassic World movies, because like some of the titles, I'll give you some of the good ones here. We've got a double cross to bear, Nostalgia-saurus.
Nice.
Raiders of Lost Isla Nubar. That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And there's something about Maisie, which was fun.
Nice.
Well, there you go.
There is something about Maisie, actually.
Oh, man. We're going to have to do a spoiler-filled episode, apparently. Those are our thoughts of the film. Let us know what you think when you go and check it out at the end of this week. We'd love to hear your thoughts on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Let us know if you agree. Let us know if you disagree. Let us know if you think Spencer just needs to stop laughing at dinosaurs dying. Just it's horrible.
Okay.
So
watch this movie, people, wow. And tell me if it doesn't look comical.
Well, on that note, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.